Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:40 on the afternoon of Wednesday, February 10th, 2010. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Egan is here, Senator Wilkowski, myself, Senator French. We've got two new bills up before us, but we also have one bill previously heard that we will go ahead and bring up first, and that is SB 246, increasing the number of judges. The bill is pretty straightforward. We increase the number of judges by one to serve in the 3rd Judicial District. And I'm wondering if any of the members of the committee have any questions or follow-up based on the presentation we got at the last hearing from Mr. Woolimer. Senator Wilkowski, Senator Egan, no. Questions, comments, concerns? Senator Wilkowski,
motion,
please.
Sir. Mr. Chair, regarding SB 246, I would move that we pass the bill out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved. We'll take a short at ease. Let's go back on the record, and we have two more bills to take up, and we will begin with HB 307. I see Representative Holmes is here, my representative in the State House of Representatives. Welcome, Representative Holmes. Make yourself comfortable in the chair. Put yourself on the record. Tell us what your bill's about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Lindsay Holmes, representative for House District 26. And, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I would actually like to invite my staff, Bill Edwards, up to briefly run you through the bill.
That's fine. Mr. Edwards, welcome to the committee. You've seen other people testify. We just need you to, you can bring that one chair up if you'd like. It may be better to have two there instead of one. That's fine. Simply put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, if any, and go ahead with your testimony.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bill Edwards, staff for Representative Lindsay Holmes, and I thank you and the committee for the chance to present this bill today.
Please go ahead.
House Bill 307 is a fairly simple repair to the statutes pertaining to protective orders in cases of sexual assault. A short history on where these orders came from. Prior to 2001, protective orders existed only in cases of domestic violence. Two relevant pieces of legislation. In 2001, with HB 1, the legislature extended these protections to cases of stalking outside a domestic relationship. The legislature further extended these protections to cases of sexual assault outside of a domestic relationship in 2006 with SB 54. The problem that arose was that in order to make these work, you have to both create the protective order itself and you have to give someone jurisdiction to actually issue them. That did not happen with SB 54 in 2006. As a result, it's come to our attention that a number of magistrates and district court judges are declining to issue orders specifically in cases of sexual assault, because as the statute currently reads, they have jurisdiction to do that in cases of domestic violence and stalking only. What HB 307 would do is amend Alaska Statute 22.15.100 to give them jurisdiction to issue protective orders in cases of sexual assault in addition to stalking. This is particularly problematic in rural communities where there is no superior court available, which is the only remedy available when district courts and magistrates can't issue these orders. So correcting this oversight would ease these problems in some of these rural communities. In your bill packet, I have included correspondence between our office and Senator Dyson's office, the office that sponsored SB 54 in 2006, indicating that their intention was to include magistrate jurisdiction for cases of sexual assault. I've also included letters of support from the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and the Alaska Peace Officers Association. Again, I thank the committee, and I am available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. Questions for Mr. Edwards? I'll plunge in, and this is less about the intent of the bill, which makes complete and perfect sense, and it kind of goes back to some history. SB 54, what happened? We added the sex assault to a list and a separate statute, I take it. And where is that? What statute is that? Do you know?
Yes. The sexual assault statute is AS 18-65-850 okay. through 870.
Mm-hmm.
And this statute was created with HB 1 in 2001. The statute was originally only for stalking. The 2006 Act extended the stalking statute to cases of sexual assault as well.
So it put the sex assault aspect in the list of domestic violence protective orders that sort of exist. That is, the forms exist for them. There's a statutory home for them to exist. But there's just no sort of order or authority to a judge. A judge can say, that's great, it's on the books, but there's still nothing that tells me I can issue one.
Correct. As the case was left after 2006, no update to jurisdiction for district courts had been given. As a result, these defaulted to the general original jurisdiction of superior courts. And as far as we're aware, the magistrates are correct. However inconvenient that may be, the statutes don't give them jurisdiction in this case, so a literal reading of the statutes as written is correct in that they don't have jurisdiction for these.
Sure. Let's stop and welcome Senator McGuire to the committee. Welcome, Senator McGuire. We're on HB 307,
great.
And we're sort of mulling over how it was that we came to neglect so badly to grant the right authority to judges when we expanded under old SB 54 sex assault protective orders for sex assault. Further questions or comments? There is, just so folks who are listening understand, a victim of a crime can get a no-contact order from the judge handling the criminal case. So there's an avenue now for victims to get a no-contact order if they've been a victim of a sex assault. But I guess not every case goes to court, or at least not every case goes to criminal court. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. These exist. The sexual assault protective orders, one thing that people would think in hearing about this is, well, sexual assault is clearly a crime. The perpetrators are going to be locked up. Clearly there should be other remedies. For a number of reasons, including hesitation to report, including hesitation to disrupt a family situation, for all of the reasons that sexual assaults don't always get reported, situations can arise where there is a case of sexual assault and not an accompanying criminal case. So the remedy for victims in those cases to protect themselves from their assailants is to get a protective order for sexual assault. That's why the statute was created in 2006.
Sure. And we had a stirring address earlier today about intergovernmental cooperation and so forth. And I'm wondering now, more just for the sake of conversation than to put you on the spot or the bill sponsor, but I just wonder, in those cases where you have a victim asking for a sex assault protective order, where there's been no criminal charge filed, I just sort of wonder what the system's response to that set of facts should be. And you don't have to answer, but it's just something I'm pondering as we sit here. Further questions for the bill's sponsor? Looks like you've stumped the panel of experts. Well done, Mr. Edwards. Let me see if there's anybody online who'd like to testify about HB 307. Anybody here in the room that wants to testify on behalf of the bill? With that, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony. And any closing remarks you'd like to make? My intention is to hold the bill over one hearing, as I do with just about practically every bill that comes through the committee, so we can mull it over and then take action at a future hearing.
No, Mr. Chairman, I'll refer to my boss, but I think everything's been covered, although it looks like there might be one question.
Oh, good. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, yep. Through the chair. So I'm surprised, too, that we overlooked that, but in that same vein, have you explored all of the other categories that might be considered when you're thinking about a protective order and the value of that, to be sure that it is only sexual assault then that we want to add? Are there any other, have you taken that sort of walk down the statutes to say, okay, do we have it all now?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator McGuire, we have actually been working with the court system once this bill was introduced, and there are other jurisdictional issues that the court system may at some point in the future want to look into, but they do not appear to relate to restraining orders and protective orders. There are other things similar to this where maybe they might want to consider giving magistrates jurisdiction, but they are not in the realm of protective orders.
Okay, and then through the chair, if I might, you know, it just strikes me that, and maybe it's the case that some people would think this was too much judicial discretion, but it strikes me that we want to give tools to the people that are on our bench to execute justice and to prevent further harm, and that I wonder now as I'm looking at it why we are even narrowing it. I didn't understand then why we stalking didn't include a stranger. That was odd to me as well, that the way we defined our stalking statute at the time meant you had to have an interpersonal romantic relationship. And so now I'm looking at this and I'm just wondering, do we want to allow magistrates to issue protective orders in other cases? I mean, are there other cases out there that they're seeing where they just say, you know, as part of what we're going to do here, we're going to issue a protective order to prevent further harm? I don't know.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, the narrow focus of this bill is for the specific reason that it's addressing one distinct problem that yep. exists right now, that is the magistrates that aren't issuing protective orders in these specific cases. To the broader question, I don't know that I have any particular authority to say what the legislature should or shouldn't do, but it's a pretty legitimate question. It may very well be the case that there are other circumstances that judges should be empowered to issue protective orders under and not wait until there's been an actual real victimization. I mean, sexual assault's a pretty big thing. You know, maybe we shouldn't have to wait until someone's actually been sexually assaulted to issue one of these protective
yeah.
orders.
Yeah, I mean, sorry.
Yeah, no.
Through the chair,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
that's kind of what my point is that what we've spent a lot of time in this committee over the years talking about is that once you reach that point of victimization, there's a soul damage, if you will, that's gone forever. And then we spend, you know, the rest of our time trying to put the pieces back together as best we can through violent crimes compensation, education, et cetera. But anyway, so I guess not to belabor the point, but it would be interesting to perhaps have a conversation with the magistrate bar, if there is one or a collection of them, to find out if there are other circumstances or places that they would prefer to have that tool in their tool belt in earlier. And go ahead and spell that out as well.
It's an interesting point. The I guess I'm also thinking though that we frequently get pushback, legitimately so, because these can be used both defensively. You know, 95 times out of 100 they're used appropriately, but every now and then they're used in the other manner. And you could see protective orders issued. You know, I own an apartment building. And you could have a sort of a little two-tenant dispute over a parking spot that suddenly, you know, results in someone getting a protective order against somebody else. Yeah. And, you know, then what? You know, you can't go home because your neighbor's unhappy with the way you handled the parking spot dispute. So it's a great conversation. But I guess keep in mind, and we mentioned earlier, that you know, no contact orders are always available mm-hmm. anytime there's been a crime committed. But you're talking about something upstream of that. So it's interesting. Well, and that's why we'll mull the bill over for a day or so. Anything else from the bill sponsor? Or you, Mr. Edwards?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank you and the committee for hearing this bill so quickly, and we look forward to the next conversation.
Glad to do it. And I'm right in thinking this is the only committee of referral on this side?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Thanks so much. Great. Anything else from the committee? Yep. With that, we'll set the bill aside. Thank you so much for coming and presenting to us. And turn now to CS for Senate Bill number 194, and it's the bill sponsor is here as well. Senator Meyer, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Nice to have you in front of the committee. And I know, because I've heard this bill, but you can tell the others what your bill
sure.
is.
Sure, sure. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask my trustee staff here, Christine, to join me as well. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Senator Kevin Meyer, represent South Anchorage, and I'm here to introduce to you Senate Bill 194, an act relating to civil penalties as it pertains to alcohol violations. Basically, this bill is just to amend or upgrade a current bill that we have in place.
Mm-hmm.
What is new with this particular bill, though, not only are we going from $1,000 to $1,500 as far as the civil penalties, but also we're including now an optional education provision. And we have to make it optional, we're told, because this is a civil penalty and not a criminal penalty. But basically, the bill does three things. First of all, as I mentioned, it'll allow civil damages to go now from $1,000 to $1,500 for someone who tries to buy alcohol who's underage with a fake ID, or someone who is an adult and does buy for a minor. Now, in the case of the second one, there are some pretty tough criminal penalties in place for an adult buying for a minor, but this would now allow someone to take civil action as well as criminal action if they're purchasing for a minor. And then, as I mentioned, third is just an educational component, which may require someone under 21 to pay for and enroll in some kind of juvenile alcohol safety action program if there's one available. Some locations, that's not possible. And just to give you some history on this, I first introduced this and was involved with this in 1997, when I was on the Anchorage Assembly. And what was happening was that the licensees were frustrated in the sense that kids would come and try to buy booze, and they'd get the ID, the fake ID, they'd keep it, they'd call the police sometimes wouldn't even show up. And if they did, they would just say, you know, okay, thanks, but we're too busy. We're not going to take any action. And so the licensee was frustrated because if they accidentally sell to a minor, then they lose their license, and so it could be quite an expense to them. So they wanted some means of taking action against kids who were trying to buy illegally. And it has worked. Hopefully you'll hear from some of the licensees this afternoon, and so it was so successful in Anchorage. Then we had some folks in Fairbanks who also wanted to use the same program. So we brought it before the state legislature in 2001, and that's when it first passed. Now, obviously, that's almost 9-10 years ago, and costs have gone up considerably, especially costs in trying to track down these kids to let them know that you have to go to civil court. And so that's why the licensees are saying that they'd like to see the penalty go up from $1,000 to $1,500. This, I believe, Mr. Chairman, is truly a win-win situation. Win-win in the sense that it helps us as a legislative body make sure that the laws that we are passing and that kids don't have access to underage kids don't have access to alcohol. And it also assists responsible licensees to be proactive in helping us enforce these laws. And as I mentioned, it has been a success, and it's a program that I'd like to see us continue. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Thank you, Senator Meyer. Senator McGuire has a question.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. I've got a couple questions. First, I wanted to know, on these civil actions, if the person involved is a minor, is the civil action brought against the parent who is named in the lawsuit?
Mr. Chairman, and again, we'll have some folks here that can tell how the program works, but it's my understanding that it goes against the child.
Okay. And then I've got three questions. And the next question is, any feedback from the court about what the caseload is like in terms of having these on there? They're settling out, I understand that, but how many of these are being filed and what is it doing to our courts?
Senator McGuire, through the chair. Let me back up. Most of the, and again, we'll hear from the licensees, most of the kids that are trying with fake IDs are over age 18. So you're okay. Looking at 18 to 21. So you would go right after the kids and not the parents. Second question is that I think we heard when this came up in state affairs that Brown Jug, for example, was averaging about 3 or 4 a week that they were pursuing. Now, that's just Brown Jug. Obviously, the smaller establishments will go through CHAR, and then CHAR will take action on behalf of the smaller licensees. But bigger licensees like Brown Jug and Chokuts, they pursue it themselves. What effect this is having on the courts, I couldn't answer that.
Okay. And then my final question is, did you consider at any point adding the ability to bring a civil action against a person who's violating a court order not to purchase alcohol. In other words, they've got a restriction on their driver's license, and if you haven't considered it, it's something I think we ought to think about, because I do think this is an incentive, and I think if the criminal side of it, if the police don't have the resources to enforce it, what do you do to send that message? And I think being sued, mm-hmm. irrespective, and $1,500 is a lot of money to a kid, but just that fact of being sued, I think, leaves an imprint, and I think we ought to consider expanding it to folks who try to come in and purchase alcohol when they know they've been ordered not to.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, certainly, the committee can amend the bill however they want to. So you, in this case, in your case, you'd be looking at just the adults.
Yeah.
Yeah. Adults trying to purchase when they're not supposed to. Yeah, I think that would certainly work as a deterrent. Sure.
You know, you've got habitual reoffenders, and that's part of what the court's trying to do now is say that, you know, if you have four DUIs or three DUIs, you know, you can't drink. We're not going to let you purchase alcohol. And so, okay.
Interesting idea. Thank you, Senator McGuire. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. I think that's a great idea, Senator. I know in my community, this is a big problem with people who aren't supposed to be drinking, and they habitually go to the liquor store and try to purchase alcohol. So I would support that wholeheartedly. The question that I had was on the penalty. Are Section 1 and Section 2 two separate $1,500 penalties, or is that one $1,500 penalty and you just need two sections to do it?
Okay. Well, I'll let Christine answer that. It's my understanding it's $1,500 per section, but
welcome. Hi, Christine.
For the record, my name is Christine Marisig, and I'm a staffer to Senator Kevin Meyer. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. Yes, those are two separate ones. One has to deal with the minor that is on the premises or is trying to obtain access to the premises. That's the licensee. And the second one has to do with somebody who is 18 and over or an emancipated minor who is trying to purchase for somebody who is not allowed to have access to alcohol.
Okay. I misread.
Would that be 18 and over or 21 and over?
That would be 18 and over, so that would include somebody who is 21 and over and an emancipated minor. So somebody who's an emancipated minor could be even younger than 18.
If I could just follow up, Mr. Chair. On Section A, then,
just for the record, Section 2.
I'm sorry, Section 1. Section 1.
Section 1, okay, good.
Of the bill. Yep. So I'm just trying to figure out in my head how this would work. So someone goes into a liquor store, they try to purchase liquor, they're underage, then the liquor store could bring an action against. So it would be the liquor store actually filing for civil damages,
mm-hmm.
and the money would go to the liquor store. It wouldn't go to the police department or something like that. No. Okay.
Mr. Chair and Senator Wilikowski, each establishment kind of does it a little bit differently. I think what you'll find is that the money they get, the licensee, then a lot of times they give it to their employee as an incentive to try to catch these kids.
And then, do we have any idea of how many cases have been brought under Section 1 or Section 2? Is that in here somewhere?
There is. I know in the State Affairs Committee we had good testimony from the brown jug guy. His name escapes me right at the moment.
O.C. Madden.
O.C. Madden, about how many cases they were bringing. I think they're probably the leading sort of user of the statute, but I'm sure others do as well. But and it looks like we're still waiting to get him online. Senator, anybody else have a question while we're on that point? Let me just point out, just for the record, or anyone who might, somebody listen to this, is that Section 1, AS 04-16049E, is about access of persons under the age of 21 to licensed premises. So this is underage people sneaking into bars, trying to use fake IDs and so forth to buy liquor. 065 is someone who is over 21 who buys for someone under 21.
Sure,
so it's the hey mister idea that Senator Meyer has been good about imprinting on our minds. Further questions for the bill sponsor? Committee discussion. Can you, either one of you, give us a little bit of information about this juvenile alcohol safety action program that Section 4 envisions?
Hmm.
Christine Marisigan for Senator Kevin Meyer's office. Senator French, yes, there. I had actually asked the Division of Health and Social Services about the juvenile action safety programs. And in FY09, the Division of Behavioral Health had this program in the following communities: Mat-Su, Homer, Kotzebue, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai, Kodiak, Ketchikan, Dillingham, Seward, and Anchorage. An additional $200,000 was available in FY09 for the programs to use to assist juveniles with service access. I believe the way that it's written in CSSB 194 is that when in talking with legal about having some sort of educational program included in this bill, which was requested by people that use it, the licensees themselves, they had said that it would be kind of difficult since it's between the licensee and somebody who's they're taking civil action against. But a way that we were able to do that is to make it voluntary, so that it would be a recommended action for someone. And we have also written it in such a way that it could include other alcohol education or treatment programs if they deem that that would be a better fit.
Thank you. Any questions based on that? Don't hear or see any. Further questions for the bill sponsor or Ms. Marsigan? Hearing and seeing none, thank you so much for being here. Do we have anybody online? Looks like the answer is no. Okay. Anybody in the room that wants to testify? Looks like the answer is no. Why don't we do this? There is a memo regarding a couple of statutory references we need to repeal. We probably do want to hear from Mr. Madden before the bill leaves committee. We can bring this back up at your best convenience when he's available. So you tell me when he's available, and we'll get it back on the calendar so we can wrap that up. It's a straightforward bill. This is, again, this is the only committee referral on this side, so it shouldn't be a problem to move it along when the time comes. Thanks. So any closing remarks you want to make?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, please. Yes, I think that would be great to hear from O.C. Madden. Like I said, Brown Jug's been doing this since the 90s, and very successful with it, and they can explain more with Senator Witkowski, who was asking me about how it works, because I don't really know, but it works for him, that'd be great. I know he wanted to testify today and was in a meeting, so apparently his meeting went longer, but certainly we can have him available next time.
Sounds good. I've got one small announcement to make to the committee, and we can stall for a few minutes, but I imagine folks are going to want to in the crushed, I don't know how everyone else is feeling, but this session's been very busy, and I've got, you know, all kinds of stuff stacked up all over the place. So thanks so much for being here. We'll set the bill aside for the time being and get it back up as soon as Mr. Madden's available. Before we adjourn, thank you. Let me tell the committee about something we've been trying to set up for some time, and we finally got a date. The Trooper Cybercrimes Unit, folks that are out there finding child predators and so forth through their cyber sleuthing are now ready to have us come visit them in their Anchorage headquarters. And so all the members of the committee are notified that on Friday, February 26th, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we will assemble there in Anchorage and get a tour from them about how their operation works. So that, again, that's Friday, February 26th, 4 p.m. We should be able to get the 12:40 or 1 o'clock flight or whatever it is out of Juneau, get to Anchorage, get a few minutes to compose yourselves, and then get a ride across town to that. And we'll have the exact address for you in plenty of time.
But can we go?
Yes, absolutely.
Come to our town.
You're a member of the committee.
We want
you there. Likewise, you, Senator Coghill. I know you've worked on this issue over the years, and so I just think it's a great opportunity for us to go see them in action and get an idea of what tools they have, what tools they might need, and so forth. But that's something that to our great committee staffer, Cindy Smith, has worked up a date on, and so that's the date we're going to set. It's not next Friday, but I think the Friday after. So that's the announcement. Unless there's anything else to come before the committee, or unless Mr. Madden suddenly appeared on the line, we're going to go ahead and adjourn. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.